Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. Let's begin with some of today's headlines. The first headline is for a photograph, a very large photograph on the front page of today's paper. It's called Suspension of Reality, and it's of a young child running toward the camera across a bridge with a mother closely following behind. Ian Gilkey, 4, pretends to be a dinosaur Monday as he runs across the suspension bridge, followed by his mom, Heather Gillison of Champaign, at Lake of the Woods in Mahomet. The next headline reads, Coronavirus Pandemic Testing Update. Two students suspended at U of I, over 100 under investigation. This article is written by Ben Zigderman and is based out of Urbana. As the University of Illinois tries to control the spread of COVID-19, two students and one fraternity have been suspended for coronavirus-related violations. Another 119 students and 11 groups are under investigation, Dean of Student Support and Advocacy Stephen Bryan said Monday at the Senate's Executive Committee meeting. And some students who have tested positive have broken their isolation to try to retest and get a better result. The majority of his students who are on campus have bought into the commitment we have asked them to make, Provost Andreas Kangelaris said Monday. There is a minority that is not. Those who test positive are supposed to wait at least 10 days in isolation before getting tested again, Champaign-Urbana Public Health District Deputy Administrator Avais Vaid said. But some, for whatever reason, are going multiple times and getting tested in the hope that they will test negative, he added. Still, campus officials remained hopeful Monday that the spread of the virus would be limited. We're not out of the woods yet, Chancellor Robert Jones said. But we remain hopeful and optimistic that we will be able to achieve our core objectives, and that is to come back to some form of face-to-face education with the primary purpose of keeping our faculty, our staff, and our students safe. Since move-in began August 16th, the U of I has conducted more than 126,000 tests, from which 679 unique cases have been found, according to the U of I's updated dashboard. It's unclear how many were found on arrival and how many originated elsewhere. If there are 80 cases, by the time we look for them in the state database, we may only find that 40 of them are true new cases, and 30 of them have been tested previously somewhere else, Vaid said. 80 people with COVID-19 are using isolation beds, spokeswoman Robin Kaler said, and 93 are available on campus. Two people have completed their isolation. Another 47 people with possible exposure to the coronavirus are using U of I quarantine beds, and 228 beds are available. 26 people have completed quarantine. Off campus, about 179 students are in isolation, and about 223 are in quarantine, Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs Danita Brown-Young said. If the U of I does have to return to online-only classes, Jones insisted data would drive the decision. It will be the data that drives us to make an alternative decision if we have to, Jones said. Asked later what thresholds the U of I has for moving to online-only education, officials weren't specific, but said they were looking at the state's county and regional metrics, such as case clusters, hospitalizations, and surge capacity. Right now, Champaign County is exceeding the target level of 50 new cases per 100,000 people at 124. That was expected when students came in, Vaid said. That was expected when people came back from vacation. He said that if the U of I starts to approach some of the other target levels, we will start making recommendations and changes and not really wait until we have breached some of those thresholds. In addition to requiring everyone on campus to test twice a week, the U of I is requiring face masks and checking people's campus building entry status on the Safer Illinois smartphone app. More than 39,000 people have downloaded the app, Kaler said, but it's unclear how many have turned on the exposure notification feature because the app focuses on privacy and doesn't report that data to the U of I. U of I officials said tests were taking longer than usual to process last week, as there wasn't an even distribution of testing throughout the week. To help, the U of I sent a mass email encouraging students to do more testing on Wednesdays and the weekend. It's also working on ways to speed up the test, with new robotics in the lab and a smaller test tube. On Sunday, volunteers were encouraged to drool into two test tubes at one location to provide data for a validation study, on the smaller tubes. They're adding robotics and other means through which the process can be expedited and more automated so that the turnaround time that we have is a few hours rather than taking more than 24 hours, Congelara said. He compared the U of I's efforts to building a plane while flying. These things are happening as we speak, he said. We do believe that by the end of the week, we'll have made significant improvement there with a new way of collecting the saliva samples and the robotics. And we look forward to the week after that to pretty much be at steady state. The next headline reads, University of Illinois, campus pursuing nuclear options. This article is written by Ben Sigterman and is based out of Champaign. University of Illinois researchers are hoping to bring a micro-nuclear reactor to campus, which could be used to help heat buildings and reduce the campus's dependence on fossil fuels. To prepare the campus and the community for the possibility, the U of I's Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and Environment is hosting a virtual conversation at 4:30 p.m. September 10th with sustainability leaders, the Executive Director of Facilities and Services, and Nuclear Engineering faculty. Technology has come a long way since 1960, and so have nuclear reactors, nuclear researcher Caleb Brooks said. We'd like to have the opportunity to share with folks about these new systems, about how we could see them helping to meet our carbon production goals on campus, which we're committed to carbon neutrality by 2050. This would go a long way to helping achieve that. The U of I has joined a reactor company on a bid for a micro-reactor from the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy, Brooks said. If successful, we would have a large investment from the federal government to see that purchased system built, he said. Micro-reactors are the smallest of three classifications of nuclear reactors, Brooks said. Traditional, large-scale reactors that produce around 3,000 megawatts of energy. Small modular reactors in the 60 to 300 megawatt range, and micro reactors, which typically produce less than 20 megawatts. Micro reactors are designed to be very small so they can be built in factory and tested and then shipped complete on a truck, Brooks said. They can be put down at site where needed without any major construction, and they can be pretty easily connected to the electric grid or whatever need the reactor is used for. While the exact location would need approval from federal and state regulators, Brooks said it would make sense to be located near the Abbott Power Plant and be used to produce steam that would heat campus buildings. These nuclear reactors are nicely suited for the need that we have on campus. There's not just an electricity need, but a substantial steam need. And there aren't a lot of options for decarbonizing that steam production, Brooks said. Several hundred buildings on campus are heated by steam. The Urbana campus needs about 55 megawatts of electric power and 50 megawatts of steam power, Brooks said. And the microreactor the U of I is considering would be in the 15 to 20 megawatt range. He also said it could be used by researchers to study topics such as hydrogen production, grid resiliency, clean energy, and advanced materials. Besides explaining the technology and the campus's clean energy goals, next week's meeting will also be to hear concerns from the public. Guests need to sign up by noon at go.illinois.edu go.illinois.edu/nuclearconversation. That's go.illinois.edu/nuclearconversation on September 9th to get a Zoom invitation. The event will also be live streamed on Facebook. We want to know what concerns people have, Brooks said, and we want to address those concerns. Emeritus professor and environmentalist Bruce Hannon, H-A-N-N-O-N, already has concerns about the project, from cost and safety to location and fuel rod disposal. In Rantoul, on the old Air Force base maybe, the Clinton nuclear power plant might be a good place to put it. But in the middle of a community of almost 200,000 is a bad place to put it, Hannon said. Brooks said the university wouldn't have to take care of spent nuclear fuel. The federal government would. That is provided for by the Department of Energy, he said. And he said the microreactors are safer than large reactors because their smaller size produces less residual heat. By reducing the power of the system by three orders of magnitude, it also reduced the residual heat by three orders of magnitude, Brooks said. That can be very easily managed. He said the uranium fuel would be about the size of a grain of sand and coated in different carbides, one of which is a silicon carbide, which is like a diamond, a very strong material. That silicon carbide traps everything inside, even in very extreme temperatures, Brooks said. Nothing can get out. And he didn't say how much the microreactor would cost, but said these reactor systems can compete quite well with diesel. And since they're made in a factory, maybe the first or second will require some investment, Brooks said, but over time they can become competitive. What we hope to see is that the U.S. will begin to value carbon-free technology, and that would help with the cost competitiveness, he said. The next headline reads, National Coin Shortage. Saving your change? Cashing in helps banks stay ahead of shortage. This article is written by Deborah Pressy and is based out of Champaign. If you've got coins stashed away in a sock, a jar, or a drawer, at least one local bank is offering an incentive to cash them in. With coins in a pandemic-related short supply, CIBM Bank has begun offering a $5 bonus for every $50 worth of coins customers cash in. We just thought this would be a nice way to help out in a situation that is needed, said CIBM Bank President and CEO Brian Chaffin. According to the Federal Reserve, there is an adequate amount of coins in the economy overall, but the pace of circulation of coins has slowed down, leaving reduced inventories in some areas of the country. They have advised banks there have been some limited shipments on orders, Chaffin said. In just a couple of weeks of offering an incentive to bring coins in, CIBM Bank saw customers cash in a few $1,000s worth of coins, so there are plans to keep the offer going into October, Chaffin said. Those with coins to cash in who aren't CIBM Bank customers can take advantage of the offer too, he said. The bank just asks that they open a savings account, and any minimum balance requirements will be waived, he said. I wouldn't call it a dramatic issue yet. I don't think we'll get to that, Chaffin said of the shortage. We just wanted to get ahead of it. Several other area banks said the coin shortage hasn't been an issue for them. Gifford Bank President Tony McLean said the Fed has put a limit on the amount of coins banks can get, but we have not had any issues whatsoever here, he said. That bank serves more consumer customers than commercial customers, he said, so its demand for coins isn't as large. Kyla Poplowski, banking center manager at Prospect Bank, said that bank also hasn't experienced any coin shortages. When I saw that on the Fed's website, and they obviously sent out a letter, I thought, really? She said. Nor has First Federal Savings Bank of Champaign-Urbana experienced any coin shortage, according to Ada Durakin, Senior Vice President of Marketing and Human Resources. We do have enough customers who bring it in, so we re-roll it and use it, he said. Dewey Bank Assistant Cashier Julie Doherty said that bank also hasn't had coin shortage issues. Since the bank lobby opened about a month ago, bank customers have been making use of the coin machine, and that's providing another source of coins for the bank, she said. People do bring their coins in periodically, Dougherty said. The impact may be felt more at certain businesses. The Thornton's gas station at 101 South Mattis Avenue in Champaign has been asking customers to pay in the exact amount if they can, since coins have been harder to get. If they can't pay in the exact amount, we're still able to give a little change back, said manager Jerry Watros. We don't have an overabundance, he warned. The next headline reads, Restore Illinois Phase 4, Day 68 by the numbers. Here's a quick rundown. Illinois, 235,023 cases. That's up 1,668. And there have been 8,026 deaths, which is up by 7. Out of Champaign County, 2,369 cases. That's up 49. Douglas, that's 225 cases. That's up by 3. Ford County, 103 cases, that's up by 2. Piatt County, 86 cases, that's up by 1. And Vermilion County, 330 cases, and that's up by 6. Illinois impact. 61820 zip code has most active cases in Champaign County by 294, 4th in Danville, or 4th Danville prison staffer tests positive. The next headline reads, Top of the Morning, Something to Get You Going Today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. How did members of the Tuscola Kiwanis Club feel about their goodwill gesture on Saturday? Sore, Suzanne Rominger said. A handful of Kiwanians spent the day putting together 20 wooden benches that fold out into tables that will benefit the cooped-up kids at Tuscola's North Ward and East Prairie schools. Rominger, a special education teacher at Tuscola High, was impressed when the student council spearheaded a project that resulted in an outdoor classroom a few years ago. We thought it would be wonderful to have the same thing at the middle school and grade school, she said. This gives them a place to have a mask break, lunch, classes, just somewhere to sit down outside. Thanks to donated lumber from the Cabot Corporation, Cabot, C-A-B-O-T, Rominger and company put their woodworking skills to use, completing the project in one busy day. I was exhausted, but it felt very good, said Ian Rominger, Suzanne's husband. It was good for the soul, very satisfying. And there are two large photos in this section of the paper. One is of a man. I think he has, it's a saw. I don't know what kind of saw. And he's sawing up some wood. And then you see a picture of two of the completed benches. They look very nice. The next headline reads, History. Area history. In 1920, a slight injury resulting from cranking a car several weeks ago caused the death of William Wozencraft, a Champaign plumber. Wozencraft, 59, dislocated a rib while cranking his car, and the injury caused an abscess of the liver. In 1970, five Illinois cities are experiencing teacher strikes: Urbana, Bloomington, El Dorado, Galicia, and Collinsville. Teachers in the East Moline District are back to work after a circuit court order. In 2005, following a 40-minute closed session to discuss pending litigation and then a 70-minute public discussion, the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District Board voted 5-1 to annex Southwest Champaign, including the Turnberry Ridge, Glenshire, Lincolnshire Fields, Fields West, Ironwood, Trails at Brittany, and Copper Ridge subdivisions. Champaign County Board Member Scott Tapley said he and his neighbors could file as many as 2 lawsuits to stop the annexation. In international history, today's highlight, on September 1, 1945, Americans received word of Japan's formal surrender that ended World War II. Because of the time difference, it was September 2 in Tokyo Bay, where the ceremony took place. Also on this date in 1939, World War II began as Nazi Germany invaded Poland. In 1942, U.S. District Court Judge Martin I. Welsh, ruling from Sacramento, California, on a lawsuit brought by the ACLU on behalf of Fred Korematsu, upheld the wartime detention of Japanese Americans as well as Japanese nationals. In 1972, American Bobby Fischer won the International Chess Crown in Reykjavik, Iceland, as Boris Spassky of the Soviet Union resigned before the resumption of Game 21. In 2005, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin issued a desperate SOS as his city descended into anarchy amid the flooding left by Hurricane Katrina. In 2009, Vermont's law allowing same-sex marriage went into effect. The next headline reads, Coronavirus Pandemic. Summer could give way to bleaker fall. Experts say school reopenings, holiday travel, and more indoor activity could increase transmission. This article is written by Carla K. Johnson for the Associated Press. As the summer of COVID-19 draws to a close, many experts fear an even bleaker fall and suggest that American families should start planning for Thanksgiving by Zoom. Because of the many uncertainties, public health scientists say it's easier to forecast the weather on Thanksgiving Day than to predict how the U.S. coronavirus crisis will play out this autumn. But school reopenings, holiday travel, and more indoor activity because of colder weather could all separately increase transmission of the virus and combine in ways that could multiply the threat, they say. Here's one way it could go. As more schools open for in-person instruction and more college students return to campuses, small clusters of cases could widen into outbreaks in late September. Public fatigue over mask rules and other restrictions could stymie efforts to slow these infections. A few weeks later, widening outbreaks could start to strain hospitals. If a bad flu season peaks in October, as happened in 2009, the pressure on the healthcare system could result in higher daily death tolls from the coronavirus. Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has said that scenario is his biggest fear. One certainty is that the virus will still be around, said Gerard Niemi, a disease modeling expert at Iowa State University. We will not have a vaccine yet, and we will not have enough infected individuals for herd immunity to be helpful, Niemi said. Fall may feel like a roller coaster of stop and start restrictions as communities react to climbing hospital cases, said University of Texas disease modeler Lauren Ansel Myers. Everyone should get a flu shot, she said, because if flu spreads widely, hospitals will begin to buckle, and that will compound the threat of COVID. The decisions we make today will fundamentally impact the safety and feasibility of what we can do next month and by Thanksgiving, Myers added. The virus is blamed for more than 180,000 deaths and 6 million confirmed infections in the U.S. worldwide. The death toll is put at almost 850,000, with over 25 million cases. The U.S. is recording on average about 900 deaths a day from COVID-19, and newly confirmed infections per day are running at about 42,000, down from their peak in mid-July when cases were topping out at more than 70,000. Around the country, a chicken processing plant in California will close this week for deep cleaning after nearly 400 workers got sick, including 8 who died. And college campuses have been hit by outbreaks involving hundreds of students, blamed in some cases on too much partying. Schools including the University of North Carolina, Michigan State, and Notre Dame have moved instruction online because of clusters on their campuses. Several vaccines are in advanced testing, and researchers hope to have results later this year. But even if a vaccine is declared safe and effective by year's end, as some expect, there won't be enough for everyone who wants it right away. More than 90 million adults are 65 or older or have health problems, putting them in higher danger of severe consequences if they get sick with the coronavirus. Many of them and their families are starting to decide whether to book holiday flights. The next headline reads, Election 2020. Postmaster faces subpoena by House Oversight Committee. This article is written by the Associated Press and is based out of Washington. The House Oversight Committee intends to subpoena Postmaster General Louis DeJoy for documents about disruptions in mail delivery operations that are now central to questions over the ability to handle an onslaught of mail-in ballots expected for the November election. Representative Carolyn Maloney, Democrat from New York, the committee chair, sent a memo Monday saying DeJoy blew past last week's deadline to fully respond to the committee's request for more information. He has not provided any new materials, she said. It is clear that a subpoena has become necessary to further the committee's investigation and help inform potential legislative actions, she said. Democrats are aggressively pursuing oversight of postal operations after President Donald Trump railed against making mail-in ballots. Trump suggested he wanted to starve the Postal Service of funds to make it more difficult to handle the surge expected in November. DeJoy, who was tapped to lead the agency in June, started quickly initiating changes at a time when the agency was already straining under the COVID-19 crisis. Reports of delays soon piled up. Communities across the nation complained about widespread disruptions in postal operations this summer as blue mailboxes and sorting equipment were removed, and employees said changes in trucking operations and overtime hours left mail on the loading docks undelivered. The community produced internal postal service data showing widespread summer service disruptions. DeJoy, who testified before the panel earlier this month, reiterated in a letter last Friday that the changes he was initiating are now being suspended until after the election is concluded. The committee is seeking documents about the changes. And there's a photograph in the paper of a man that has a poster that says, "Stop delaying America's mail." And the caption underneath it is, "Paul Shevlin, a USPS employee based in Pasadena, California, protests against Postmaster General Louis DeJoy's service changes within the U.S. Postal Service ahead of the November general election." And the man is wearing a mask with his arm up, and that photograph is provided to the News Gazette by Irfan Khan of Los Angeles Times, TNS. The next headline reads, "Ask the Admin, a daily question for Champaign-Urbana Public Health's Julie Pride." Early in the COVID-19 outbreak, we were told to flatten the curve, that is, lower the numbers to a level that hospitals could manage. Have we been successful in our county, state, and nation in flattening the curve? That was the question. Answer: Champaign County and Region 6, which Champaign County is a part of, have not exceeded our healthcare capacity. If you would like to keep track of where we are in terms of healthcare capacity in our community, please go to dph.illinois.gov/countymetrics. That's dph.illinois.gov/countymetrics. It is important to understand that flattening the curve is not a one-time event. We will have peaks and valleys of cases throughout the pandemic. It is crucial that we take the appropriate measures to prevent outbreaks and community transmission. We will need to adjust activities from time to time until the pandemic ends. We will also need to mask, distance, and continue to wash hands frequently until the pandemic is over. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been the reading of Part 1 of the News Gazette for today, Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. It's always a pleasure to read with you. Thank you very much for listening. I'll resume shortly with Part 2 of the News Gazette, so please stay with me. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful day.